of St. Louis, Missouri, USA, on the occasion of the 20th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous at the convention in St. Louis. You're about to hear Ebby, who is in his hotel room in the Jefferson Hotel, who's going to tell us his story.
This is Ebby speaking from St. Louis, the 20th anniversary convention of AA. I'm very happy to be here. I consider myself fortunate in being able to make the trip from Dallas, Texas, where I'm now living. It's good to see Bill again. I haven't seen much of him in the last couple of years, although he did make the trip to Fort Worth at the Texas State Convention a year ago, this past June. As a good many people know, I attended school in Manchester, Vermont, with Bill Wilson, in 1912. I was born in Albany, New York, and attended the Albany Academy in that city. And I summered in Manchester. In 1912, I formed a great friendship with a son of the minister in the Congregational Church in that town. This boy's name was Roger Perkins. And I believe as I look back that he had a great deal to do with giving me many fine ideas about life. He was a splendid chap. He joined the Naval Aviation in World War I and was killed in Pensacola, Florida, flying. Bill and I also were very close friends during that year in school, and we spent a good many hours talking together. I returned to my school in Albany, but I never finished out. I believe it was in 1914, sometime in the winter, February, January, somewhere along there. I walked into the hotel tonight in Albany and ordered myself a glass of beer. Very probably I'd had a sip of wine or something at home prior to that at a dinner party. Now, this was the first occasion of actually going in and buying a drink. And I know that that glass of beer tasted very wonderful to me. And I tried it again not too long afterward. And the drinking grew from then on. Times when I could handle it, and there were times when I could not. I was an in-and-outer, very decidedly showing signs of alcoholism from the beginning. As time went on, of course, I didn't see much of Bill because he lived in New York and Brooklyn. And I lived in Albany, although we did see each other on occasion in Manchester during the summertime. I didn't see much of Bill until about 1927 and 28, when Bill was in the investment business and so was I in the Albany office working for a New York firm. Bill appeared upon the scene in Albany one Saturday and phoned me, and he was downtown, and I immediately joined him. And we took on some drinks. It was the first time we'd ever had a drink together. And I was playing around with a bunch of flowers in Albany. Then we were barnstorming the Albany airport, which was rather new. And I took Bill out to a party that night, one of the apartments, and there were several of these lads gathered and girls. And somebody, either Bill or I, got the brilliant idea. Bill was on his way to Vermont, but we'd charter a plane and fly up. So I promoted the idea. I was all for it, and I got a chap named Ted Burke, and I believe that when we left Ted, he didn't think we were going through with it, but I remember I took Bill to the hotel tonight, put him up, and I went out and drank all night. I went down and got Bill the next morning, and we went over and got Ted out of bed, and a bit disgruntled, and out to the airport, and phoned Vermont. Brink said it was clear weather up there, and the post of the airstrip is about the size of a postage stamp. It's kind of a tough deal to make a pilot fly two drunks up there. But the trip was uneventful, except that most of Manchester gathered at the airport, and we staggered out of the plane upon arrival, which wasn't too good. But conditions, of course, got worse with both of us in the drinking line. And I, after my father's death, I went to live in Manchester for... Well, this was in 1932. I lived in an inn up there, and then I went and opened the house, which my father had bought a few years previous. And I lived in that house all alone. This was in 1934 in the spring. And I was drinking pretty hard, and during the course of that drinking up to about August, I had been in the toils of the law twice. Fined both times for intoxication. It was sometime in July or August, I have forgotten which, that two old friends came to see me. They dropped down the house one afternoon. Now, these chaps were not what I would really call alcoholic, but they had been heavy drinkers. But they sat and they just chewed the rag a while and kind of fussed around, and then they told me that they joined an organization called the Oxford Group, that they had found a great deal of spiritual value in it, that it helped them iron out their lives. And they came right out with the statement, "Why don't you try turning your life over to God?" As you understand them, which was the principle, one of the principles of the way the Oxford Group operated. And the more they talked, the more I was impressed. It struck me that this was the simple religion, religious ideas, rather, that I had with childlike faith as a young chap, as a very small boy, which, of course, I had lost. Perhaps not lost, it was perhaps dormant. Well, they left me a book. I've forgotten the name of that book right now, but it was written by a chap who was associated with the Oxford Group, and there was a lot of very good common sense. It dealt with the businessman and the drinking in the roaring 20s, and how he had found something to live by and to clean up his life. And I was impressed with the whole thing, but like so many of us, I still wanted to fool with a bottle. But I made a deal with a painter. I'd been trying to paint the house alone, and I'd just given it up. I couldn't get up the ladder half the time, and so I gave it up. But I made a deal with a painter, and he sent a man around with some equipment so we could string planks between two ladders as serve as a scaffold. And I really sobered up and finished that house and with this chap. But as soon as that was done, it was the old monotony of life and nothing to look forward to, so I went back to drinking. Well, the result of my neighbors complained, and I was again hauled in front of the law. I forgot to mention that there had been a third chap come to see me whom I had not known prior to this. And his name was Roland. The other two chaps were Zebra and Shep. Well, at the time that I was hauled in front of the judge at the county seat, Roland appeared. And I was released in his custody. Roland had been abroad in Switzerland and had taken a course under Jung, the famed Swiss psychiatrist, and then had become affiliated with this Oxford group. Well, I spent a few days back in the house. Roland drove me back that day. It was a Monday morning. Now, there's one thing that I would like to mention here. No, I'm ahead of myself. I was first taken down on Friday. right, ma'am. The judge said, all right, you come back here for further hearing on Monday. It was then that I was taken back to the house. And I went down cellar because I knew I had 4 or 5 bottles of ale left, and I was right cool, and I was shaking pretty badly. And I started up on these bottles, and this still small voice said, no, that's not cricket. You can... Then this other voice said, well, now, this is nonsense. You won't be able to get any more liquor in town. You've got Saturday and Sunday, and you can nurse that ale along, and you're not going to be drunk. The judge said, come back sober, but he didn't say anything about taking a drink. But I just couldn't take that. I put the thing down and walk upstairs and come down the cellar again. Finally, I took the ale under my arm and took him over and gave it to a man next door. Somehow, at that doing that, I felt a great release. Well, Ellen and I were closely associated for a long time, and I went to spend some time with him. He lived about 15 miles below Manchester in Vermont. And we had some people up, and we went out, and they made me start in speaking right away. We took a trip through Vermont. We spoke 5 times one weekend, a couple of churches, a junior college, and a couple of private gatherings in people's homes. Then Roland drove me to New York, and I lived with Shep for a while in his apartment on East 57th Street. And then I went to live in the mission operated by Calvary Episcopal Church. I might say that Calvary Episcopal Church is at that time considered the headquarters of the Oxford Group in America. Not the church itself, but the parish house, rather. Well, I was one of the 12 of the Brotherhood, so-called, who operated the mission. And as I went around, of course, I saw a great deal of my old friends in New York, and I learned that Bill had been hitting the bottle pretty heavily, and so much so that he lost most of his connections in Wall Street and was in rather bad all around town, the same as I had been in Albany, my hometown. Well, I thought the thing over, and I determined to go see Bill. Because of our old friendship, because I felt that if Bill took a hold of this thing, that he would go far on it. And I really felt that when I went over there, that he would either go for it, lock, stock, and barrel, or he would reject it entirely. I didn't think there'd be any halfway measure. Well, you know, most of you know that story. Of course, it's in the big book. And where I saw Bill, I had a talk with him. I had a little dinner first, Lois, and there was a girl who was asked in, a friend of theirs. And we later, we all adjourned upstairs, and over my talk, I guess, to nearly 1 o'clock. I remember some things, of course. Some details of that talk that Bill does not remember. For instance, when I left, Bill walked in the subway with me and put his arms around my shoulder. He said, I don't know what you got, Evie, but you got something that I want. Well, Bill didn't stop drinking right away, the same as I didn't, but he evidently was thinking about it. Because he appeared at the mission a few nights later, visibly intoxicated and with a sailor in tow that he'd picked up somewhere. Bill was sitting there when the various boys were giving testimony, and all of a sudden Bill got up, strode up to the platform, and started to speak. Most people don't know this, but the superintendent came over to me and said, get him down. I said, let him speak. He's got something on his mind, let him get off his chest. And he did. He talked right there. I don't think most people know this particular incident. Later on, as Bill told you, I was very close.
I lived in the mission for a year. At the end of this year, I joined Bill and Lois, their invitation, and lived with them for another year. Not a waste of time, I returned to Albany, as I felt that that is the place where I had caused most of my trouble through drinking, and I felt that most of my restitution should be done back there. Perhaps I have left out some of the things that these men connected with the Oxford group have taught me. It is hard to go back 20, 21 years and remember these things exactly. But the Oxford group was based on a return to first century Christian fellowship. And right now I am reminded that the Reverend Sam Shoemaker, who is the nominal head of the Oxford group in this country and who taught me so much, is present at this convention in St. Louis. And I've had the pleasure of having a couple of short chats with him, and last night walked home from the convention with him. The Oxford group had four so-called principles, somewhat similar to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, from which four principles I think that the 12 steps were built on. And these were absolute honesty, absolute love, absolute unselfishness, and absolute purity. Now, of course, these were, as these chaps told me, these were broken down into workable, everyday living. The Oxford group advocated the principle of morning meditation, or as they called it, quiet time, when you tried to release yourself, wipe out self and see if you couldn't get in tune with God as you understood him, and see if you couldn't get some guidance for the day, and to hold yourself flexible, not make any set plans wherein it was possible to do so, and try to meet each situation as it came up and meet it, believing that it was God's will that these events that came up should transpire as they do. In other words, to accept what came each day. And as you know, in AA, it's done on a 24-hour basis. Just take things as they come each day. Since I've been in Texas, I've seen more and more of the daily contract that these chaps make with God each morning. God, keep me from taking a drink today. Well, you can easily see how this sprang from the teachings of the Oxford group. It was very inclusive. The indoctrination was very thorough. They had a great many meetings similar to AA meetings today, running along the same sort of procedure. And they also had a great many so-called team meetings where people would express their thoughts freely and people would take notes. And it was really the sharing your life and your troubles and your mistakes and your errors and your imposing self into everything with other people. And it was a great catharsis. It helped immeasurably. It helped me, I know. But on my return to Albany, I perhaps began to fall back into my old ways of living. They had a small nucleus of people in the city that were trying to get an Oxford group going, but there were not many, and they were not alcoholics, although I had calls at several times to go out and see some of my old drinking buddies. One chap and his wife in particular. I knew nothing about the wife's drinking, but when I went out to talk to them, he never actually got a hold of it very well, but she sobered up. And as far as I know, she has had little, if any, trouble since that time. She became very much interested in the Oxford group. In fact, here in the convention last night, I had the word of her from some man who knew them, and he said that she was doing very well, and I'm happy to hear this. But the Oxford group did not flourish as such in Albany. It was 1936 when I returned to Albany, and I got a job in the fall of 36 in the Ford Motor Company in Green Island, which is about 12 miles north of Albany. And I worked at that job for nearly 6 months. I had a time when I was working on the night shift to make trips to New York, and I kept in touch with Bill and the boys down there who were beginning to form plans for writing the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the big book. And one of these trips down there in April, the latter part of April 1937, after 2 years and 7 months of complete sobriety, I slipped one night. And, of course, I immediately got in touch with some people. I was staying at the Lexington Hotel, and the next morning they were over bright and early and took me over to Bill's. Bill was going away, and over the weekend, I believe, and I was there in the house alone, and of course I'd started this vicious circle again, and I kept on all most of that week, returning to Albany and returning to my job on the following Monday morning, Ford Motor Company. And I was still pretty shaky. I punched my card, and the general superintendent came along, and he said, "Well," he said, "where were you all this week?" I said, "I was sick. That's my story, and I'm going to stick to it." And he smiled a little. He said, "Well, go on out there and go to work." I was working in the Springs Division as an inspector. But when I got down there, and my immediate boss, I had a pretty much of a grouch on, and he said, "We got a job for you today." He said, "The crane's broken down out in the yard, and we got to unload a car of steel." So he said, "Get going." Well, I went out there. At the end of about 2 hours, I couldn't open my hands. I was unloading these bundles of stretched steel. One man would pass them to me, and the two of us would take them over and pile them up. I stuck it out all day, but at the end of that day, I was pretty much all in, and I drove home with a man who took me to work on the day shift. I was on the day shift that time. And he said, "I've been trying to borrow some money," he said, "around the place." He said, "Because I know that you need a drink." He said, "But I couldn't get a cent." He said, "Everybody's broke on Monday morning." I said, "It's all right, I've got it." So we went to the saloon, and that was the last Mr. Ford ever saw me. A few days later, a man came around and got the badge and gave me the check, the money that was coming to me. Well, there's no use going into details that the thing has been bad. And it's been good, off and on, all these years. I went to Philadelphia in the spring of 1941. I've been in a place in New Jersey, which is a religious place for alcoholics, and where they make you work pretty hard. We were out all that winter tearing up an old track, an old railroad track, and getting the ties, and we're using them as firewood. We laid in quite a supply of that. It was good rugged work because it was cold in that railroad cut. But I went to Philadelphia, and I guess I drove up with somebody. I got there about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was drinking by 12. I couldn't stand the city after the country or something like that. At least that was the excuse. And I got in a room. I dragged myself out of the room, and I was in the park. Fairmount Park sitting around. And finally I had recourse to call on AA. And they took me to the Philadelphia General, where I spent 4 or 5 days in the psycho ward. And then I went down to see some people who had connections with this place in New Jersey that I'd been. And I got a job with them. They were an association that was very much similar to the Salvation Army, only it was just a local organization. And I worked on that truck, picking up stuff, newspapers, furniture, everything. Oh, I think about 6 weeks. And then I made a shift to a hospital. Worked as a porter for 3 months. In the meantime, I had made an application to the United States Navy Department as an inspector. And it was getting along toward the fall of 41 then. And the first reports from my application was that I was turned down. But after Pearl Harbor, they sent me another notice that I was satisfactory, so I went right from the hospital job to a job as an inspector of the Navy. This job I held for about 16 months. And I was sober all this time. But after we had the contract lick in this plant, I was stationed in a private plant, I again lost interest. And I had no way of getting out of the Navy. So I again took recourse to the bottle. And they were awfully nice to me. They sent a couple of guys over to see me, and they said, take 2 or 3 days off and have some fun because you deserve it. We know your record. You didn't take a drink on the job, and your work was satisfactory all the way through. But I just couldn't snap out of it then. I was too far gone, and I just kept on drinking. Finally, they gave me a release without prejudice. Reason, ill health. Well, I batted around Philadelphia, sobering up. Well, not getting drunk again. I served as a steward of the AA Club on South 36th Street in Philadelphia 2 or 3 occasions. Jobs with Westinghouse, job with an army, with an outfit, a contractor who was crating trucks for overseas shipment. I really had a good job there. And several other jobs. The years went on, and I finally returned to New York in 1945. And since then, up to the time I left New York in September 1953 for Dallas, it was in and out all the time. Sober 8 months, drunk a couple of months, sober 6 months, drinking again. Of course, I do not want anybody to get the impression that I've been drunk all the time, because that's not so. In the last 20 years, if you count up the months of sobriety, I can total them up to 14 years easily. And sometimes people forget that. I've had a little trouble since I've been in Dallas. I had about 5 or 6 days of drinking. But I've also had 21 and a half months of clear sobriety.